surrogacy has opened up incredible possibility for families. Science and modern medicine present new options for those who are single or LGBTQ or who face health challenges. Our guest has a strong perspective on the world of sperm donations.
What the vast majority of banks do now is either anonymous, which hopefully goes away, because I really truly believe anonymous sperm donation is unethical, and open ID at 18. And that what that means is they will tell you the name and the identity of the sperm donor that the mother or father or couple purchased through a bank. That in no way guarantees that that donor will be willing to meet that child or maintain any kind of relationship or even just answer questions via email.
Our guest is Valerie Baumann, an award-winning journalist with a focus on healthcare. Now she's telling the story of people who are circumventing traditional fertility avenues, and it's a very personal story for her.
Children never ask to be born, and when you meet adult children who are born from anonymous sperm donors who have been, you know, created in a climate of deceit and secrecy, there's a lot of heartbreak there, and I think that the industry can do better.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Valerie Baumann, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you know, your upcoming book is titled Inconceivable Super Sperm Donors, Off-the-Grid Insemination and Unconventional Family Planning. You know, your book is described as both a memoir and a piece of investigative reporting. I'm wondering if you could just share with our audience what you'd like about your own story.
Certainly. It was the first summer of the pandemic, 2020, and I was 38 years old, and I realized I was running out of time. My biological clock was ticking, and it wasn't a good time to meet somebody. And, you know, realistically, even if you meet somebody at 38, it may take a few years before you settle down and have kids. So I decided to take the plunge and try and become a single mother by choice. And I started looking at the sperm banks, but I didn't feel served by the sperm banks. I wanted to give my kid more answers than they could find on a sperm bank website. I wanted the possibility of meeting the donor potentially before age 18, or at least being able to maintain contact about any medical issues that could have genetic correlate connections that were relevant to my kid. The possibility of meeting other half siblings, became possible when I stumbled across this world that I've dubbed the world of freelance sperm, where men offer to donate sperm through websites, Facebook groups, and dating-like apps. It's kind of a wild west. There's a lot of undesirable options out there. There's a lot of creepy men doing it for the wrong reasons. But if you're patient and you take the time, you may be able to find, as I did, a very decent, wonderful person who was willing to donate sperm, who's willing to connect me with my kids' siblings and provide more information than I would ever get from a sperm bank website. My personal donor also is done donating after creating 10 families. If you go through a sperm bank, you can wind up with, 50 to 100 families and many, many, many siblings that the children can never maintain meaningful relationships with, because it's just so beyond anything a typical family structure would create. So it's not a path for everyone. It's a path that I chose. And I don't condemn nor condone it. I do tell my own story and that of others.
Wonderful.
And advise people to approach it with caution and responsibility and a lot of thought. So I would hope that the story would elevate the perspective of donor-conceived people, because the children never ask to be born. And when you meet adult children who are born from anonymous sperm donors who have been, created in a climate of deceit and secrecy, there's a lot of heartbreak there. And I think that the industry can do better.
Well, Valerie, you say that this underground or perhaps non-traditional community of sperm donors and recipients is circumventing traditional fertility avenues and meeting up on their own terms. Tell us, is there anything illegal about doing this? Anything that's considered unethical about doing this? Or this is just a choice that people have organized on their own? Is there a central organizing group, I guess, or is it people just putting themselves out there?
Well, it's interesting. It's a real gray area. The FDA did have one enforcement action that it brought against a donor over 10 years ago. And he was a donor who created his own website. He advertised his sperm, created many, many families. And the FDA ended up cracking down on him. But when it came, when his own lawyers challenged it, what really it came down to was the government is loath to tell people that there's a limit on their ability to procreate. Because he was doing it in this donation context, they basically said he should be going through a very complex FDA approved process, which costs, you know, $6,000+, where if you want to donate your sperm as a known donor, you should be tested for multiple diseases, freeze the sperm, quarantine it for 6 months, thaw the sperm at that time, retest the sperm, retest the donor, and all of this at great expense to the prospective parent or parents. And he was circumventing that because it's an absurd, you know, insurmountable cost. And the only way to get around that under FDA law is through this very vague definition of sexual partners, essentially. And so a lot of more liberal fertility clinics will consider somebody who is a former sexual partner, somebody who's had sperm and, you know, of a donor in their body before. So if you've done one home insemination, perhaps even when you weren't at a time of the month when you're not going to get pregnant, that would fit the criteria. You could get around the $6,000+ requirements and then have in-clinic treatment. But the FDA declined to better define sexually intimate partners. And so, unfortunately, the vast majority of clinics in this country conflate sexually intimate partners with romantic partners who will play a role as a parent rather than a donor. So there's a lot of gray areas. And this particular donor had his operation shut down. But as far as my research, I've not been able to find any other incidences of cracking down on donors, because again, it's a slippery slope. When you tell somebody they can only have children in this certain way or with this many people, it brings into major questions of bioethics. And people much smarter than me have been debating that and still haven't found answers.
You know, Valerie, I want to pick up on the cost issue. You've talked, you know, because you've written about the cost involved and what you call often discriminatory world of sperm banks and fertility clinics. How much money does this cost, and where did you find discrimination?
I mean, money, the cost varies because there's a number of different procedures, different medication protocols. But, you know, sperm on average costs around $1,000 to $1,200 plus, you know, say $250 to ship it to your clinic. IVF cycles can cost between $1,800 and $2,600. When you add on some of the medications, it can get upwards of like $30,000 potentially. So there's huge obstacles financially. You're just going to be cutting out a huge portion of society. I mean, the Federal Reserve had a study, I think, in the past year or two that found 50% of Americans can't afford a $400 emergency expense. If that's your circumstance, you're not going to be able to have a child if you need assistance. So the cost is just a recurring obstacle. Then again, I've also interviewed women who were lesbians who, when they talked to their doctor and said, my wife and I want to have children, the doctor wouldn't provide any information. They wouldn't talk to them about sperm banks. They wouldn't share the information because of homophobia and bias. I, for a time, went to a clinic that had a slogan along the lines of, you know, creating families one couple at a time. As a single woman, It feels a little bit like I'm an outsider. And I understand traditionally most families are going to be created by couples, heterosexual couples. However, every time I went into that clinic, they would ask me, where's your husband? When is your husband showing up? It just never registered. So as a single woman, I felt like I wasn't being served in the same way as a traditional heteronormative family would be served.
Well, you've already shown a good spotlight on some of the legal, the financial, the medical challenges, the emotional challenges that many single women and LGBT couples face as they set out to become parents. I'm curious what you and the community of people that you've spoken with have found in terms of religious objections. You know, we have so much involvement in day-to-day life in the country at this point of different religious group, different beliefs. The Catholic Church has reaffirmed its opposition to birth control period and in vitro fertilization. What's the experience of people today in the community that you've talked to about how religious groups have treated this action?
That's an interesting question. Truthfully, it's not one that comes up very often in the world of freelance sperm, because people don't find their way to a Facebook page to find a sperm donor because that was plan A. These people have gone through grief that their family planning didn't go the way they expected, that they won't be able to reproduce with the partner that they love, that they will have to turn somewhere else. So usually by the time I'm interacting with them in that setting, they've made peace that they're going to be breaking some cultural and, yes, religious taboos. So I think at this point, people are already making their peace and accepting that people aren't going to be comfortable with what they're doing. But the biological imperative to have a child, to create life, to further your family name, there's something so powerful, and it's not unique to humans. This is the essence of being a living creature. We have a drive to procreate. And yes, as humans, there are people who don't want to have children, but I feel like there's something unifying in all the voices I hear from that religion isn't going to stand in the way of their decision to move forward. So getting into the nitty gritty of the specific religious obstacles hasn't really come up for me for that reason.
I was thinking about, as you said, giving voice to all the people that you've met. You're both an author and a journalist. You've got this book coming out. Are you planning to write as a journalist on this as well in other venues? Tell us a little bit about, because it's a fascinating area of a group of, in large group of individuals who are struggling with this. And tell us about your thought process as you sort of move forward with the rollout of the book, but also thinking about other ways to communicate this very important information out to the general public.
Well, initially, I think I wanted to write the book and not become a part of it. I think as a journalist, it gets very uncomfortable making yourself part of the story. But in order to be truthful with my audience, I had to, you know, be transparent that this is something I was doing as well. And I found as a storyteller, it was just the right, it was the right narrative to carry through the narrative spine to kind of hold together the collage of different stories that I was able to put together through my 3.5 years reporting out the book. Going forward, I think there's a lot of room in this space to continue reporting on and writing about these issues. There is so much happening. Obviously, the Alabama Supreme Court ruling is raising all kinds of questions. The reversal of Roe v. Wade. A woman's right to choose isn't just about the choice to not be a mom. It's a choice to be a mom, too. We should have rights and access to our own reproductive decisions that too often, you know, a physician or a sperm bank can throw up obstacles, whether they be financial or judgmental. I also think that there's a lot of room to discuss the evolving nature of the American family. The traditional family structure is fantastic. I would have loved to have been able to give my child a father. It didn't work out that way. And more often you're seeing LGBTQ plus families, single women, and others establishing unique dynamic families. I'm very fortunate that my donor has created a private Facebook page where I and other parents can connect. And so the siblings meet each other. That's an extended network of family. My kid will grow up and have other siblings that say, yeah, I share this with my half brother or my half sister. And there are other families that are reflected back in my world that look just like mine. And what does that mean? And I think being more open and welcoming to other kinds of families is always going to be a positive thing. And I'm really curious to see where that goes and what stories there are there.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is not just, as you said earlier, people are designed to procreate not only here in America, but across the globe. Anything you've picked up internationally that's going on in terms of best practices or things that are troublesome?
Well, I think there's a lot internationally going on. I mean, I know of one sperm donor who was banned from New Zealand and Canada, and I think Australia, because he was very open. And when he was trying to enter those countries, he's an American, saying he was just there to donate. Australia has made really interesting strides limiting the number of children who can be created by one individual donor at a bank. It varies from state to state in Australia. But a lot of them limit to 5 to 10 children per donor, and they actually require, which is not required in the U.S., tracking. So the parents who have donor-conceived children via a sperm bank must report back every birth. That is not a requirement in the U.S. Banks in the U.S. don't have any limits by law that on how many children can be produced by one donor. The Society for Reproductive Medicine, I believe it is, suggests limiting 25 per 800,000 population area, which, if you think about it, with the size of the U.S., that could create so many children. And so, but you have this tension, what you're seeing in Australia with the limits they're creating, there's a huge shortage of sperm donors. And so there's the tension between costs getting driven up because there, you know, are ethical ramifications, ethical forethought about, you know, limiting these donations, but then you have less men willing to donate, less donations available. And so there's this kind of ethical versus financial tension. And I'm really interested to see how that's going to play out in the U.S. and abroad.
Well, Valerie, you've raised so many interesting questions. We're so glad to have a chance to talk with you. But one of them is that we understand that in the open donor arena, that the child has the opportunity to contact the sperm donor when they're 18, if they wish to do so. But in the description that you've given us so far, it sounded like people pretty much were in contact or had the option of being in contact all along. So is this not an opportunity, but an obligation? Are sperm donors giving their consent now that in 18 years, even if this child has not reached out to me, I am giving my consent now to be contacted? Tell us more about that. And have we had enough years to know how this actually works out in practice?
So what the vast majority of banks do now is either anonymous, which hopefully goes away, because I really truly believe anonymous sperm donation is unethical, and open ID at 18. And that what that means is they will tell you the name and the identity of the sperm donor that the mother or father or couple purchased through a bank. That in no way guarantees that donor will be willing to meet that child or maintain any kind of relationship or even just answer questions via email. Ultimately, if you're child number 72 knocking on this person's door, because there are no limitations on how many children can be created by one donor at a certain bank, and many of these donors go to multiple banks, then you are never going to be, they're never going to have the emotional and time bandwidth to actually engage and create a meaningful relationship or just give simple answers to this child, those children about where they come from. And as you see in my book, that is heartbreaking and devastating for some of these now adult donor conceived people who feel like they had this, you know, father-shaped hole or unanswered questions in their life. And they think, oh, when I turn 18, it's all going to come, you know, it's all going to come clear. You know, one woman I spoke with, she went through a 6-month process where she was only allowed to interact with the donor anonymously. And he just kept saying she was too pushy. She wanted too much. And, you know, it's a very complex layered process, but I think people are not made aware that if they buy sperm from a sperm bank, there is no guarantee that at 18, your child is going to get all these questions answered. Mm-hmm. Now, I do want to say there's work done by a fantastic developmental psychologist named Susan Galambach out of the UK that shows the vast majority of outcomes for children of single mothers by choice and donor conceived children are very positive. A lot of times because these children are had with intention, unlike overarching stats for single mothers, they tend to have much better outcomes in life. But you just can't predict how they're going to feel about wanting to know the donor that helped create them. Some of them don't care. Some of them do. Some of them desperately want a relationship. Some of them just want one meeting and that's it. The point is, you will never know. As much as you wound up different than your parents expected you to wind up, be prepared for your child to surprise you and give them the best options available to make their own decisions and have their own feelings and be individuals unto themselves.
Well, that's great. You know, Valerie, I want to go back. We talked a little earlier about expenses, and then you sort of noted that, you know, people with limited means may have trouble covering those. But we know in 15 states require some private insurers to cover some fertility treatment, but significant gaps in coverage remain. Do you think policymakers should look at changes that would eliminate the challenges with insurance?
Absolutely. I mean, I personally believe everyone should have the right to access assisted reproductive care. And I think that it should be standard in the industry. I think that there's a lot of things that we don't do in this country, like guaranteed paid maternity leave. We don't take care of parents. And then we look at crime and educational outcomes, and we're like, oh, boo-hoo, why is this happening? We need to support parents better, even before the child is born. And I think that making IVF accessible and making, you know, any reproductive assistance available, including the outrageously expensive medications, is one of the first steps. And some people, while I believe that it's possible to go through the world of freelance sperm and take the route I did responsibly and safely, there are a lot of women out there who aren't maybe as educated or cautious or more desperate, and who are meeting men at motels off the side of the highway 2 hours away from where they live and getting sperm donated without seeing STI tests, without getting genetic testing done, without taking all the steps to protect themselves. And by making these costs so insurmountable, we are thrusting women and couples into this desperate place because of, again, the biological imperative is not going to go away. Society can shake its finger and say, well, you shouldn't have a kid then, all they want. But the fact is, it's going to happen, and we can't just stick our head in the sand.
Valerie, you may have mentioned this, but if you did, I think I missed it. I am interested in hearing more about either ethical or legal responsibilities of a sperm donor to reveal genetic or biologic health issues. How much testing or information in the network that you're describing, how much is required in that area of the donor?
I mean, nothing is required. It's the Wild West. I think it's up to the recipient to say, I only want to work with a donor who is willing to do this. But I would also caution against assuming you're protected by going through a sperm bank. Mm-hmm. There's a very famous case about the Zytex sperm bank that used a donor for 16 years, and he produced at least 36 children that they know of. He advertised himself as like having a PhD and being this great musician, when in truth he had, you know, schizoaffective disorder and was a convicted criminal. And
Valerie, so let me get one last question in, just because I know our time's running, but I think this is one that lots of people would like to hear the answer to. Can you tell us about the best way to inform children about how they were conceived? And is it necessary conversation? And when should it occur?
From all the studies that I've read and the experts, psychologists that I've spoken with, you should start talking to your child about where they come from before they can even speak. I'm 7 months pregnant, and I'm talking to my baby about the fact that a man helped me create him. I think I'm going to be putting together a storybook that talks about who that donor is and how they came to come into the world. You never want your child to grow up and say, I remember the moment that I found out I was donor conceived. If it's part of their story, their origin story, for as long as they can remember, you've done something right.
Let's try to take a look at what's happening down with the Alabama Supreme Court ruling that frozen embryos are humans. The court also said that those who destroy them can be held liable for wrongful death. What's your reaction to the decision? What effect do you think it's having, not only in Alabama, but nationwide?
Well, I'm already seeing the effect it's having. I'm very plugged into communities of women struggling with infertility, women trying to get pregnant, single mothers by choice or aspiring single mothers by choice. And I've seen women from Alabama posting saying, oh my gosh, I was supposed to have an egg retrieval, or I was supposed to have an embryo transfer, and it's been canceled because I'm in Alabama, or I'm trying to have my embryos transferred from Alabama to another state where there isn't going to be this kind of obstacle, but none of the companies that will transport embryos are willing to touch anything from Alabama. So this has already created a huge obstacle for prospective parents, and it's heartbreaking. I myself am currently 7 months pregnant. It's taken me 4 years to get to this point. People who get to the point of doing IVF have huge struggles, emotional turmoil, often loss, miscarriage. And so to be told that you can't move forward because of the Supreme Court decision is just a heartbreaking slap in the face.
And for our listeners, I think everybody knows that IVF or in vitro fertilization involves combining eggs and sperm outside the body to produce embryos. 2% of U.S. births occur through IVF. U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth is introducing federal legislation to protect IVF access following the Alabama decision. But I think the question, Valerie, is, one question. People you profiled in your book thought they were doing something out of love for the good of their family and a reasonable next step to reach this goal in their life, probably never expected to be part of a legal fight. What's the sort of feeling on the ground in terms of shock, disappointment, anger? Tell us more about what you're hearing from your community.
Sure. In my book, I talk about people who pursue a very alternative avenue to becoming a parent, that is finding a sperm donor on the internet, via Facebook groups, dating-like apps. And I personally found a donor that way and then ended up doing IVF with the assistance of that donor. But these are people who find themselves in those situations because the traditional route has not been working for them, or they felt left out of the traditional fertility clinic. A lot of people who are served by this underground network of sperm donors are LGBTQ plus couples or individuals, single women who don't have a partner but want to still become parents before they run out of time. And already they feel often not served by the traditional route to getting assisted reproductive treatment. Finding another obstacle can be thrown at them. And then the fear that it's not just going to be Alabama, this could spread across the country, is terrifying. I think so many people feel disenfranchised. They have so little choice. They have so many gatekeepers determining whether or not they can be parents. It's no longer up to them. It's all in other people's hands. And so to add one more layer of that, where in some cases people's opportunity to become parents is literally being stolen from them. They have spent tens of thousands of dollars to produce embryos and can't do anything with them. That's a loss that they will grieve for the rest of their lives.
Valerie Baumann, thanks for joining us. The book is Inconceivable. The publisher is Union Square and Company, and it's available for pre-orders right now. And thank you to our audience for being here. Be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X under our account name, CHC Radio. And as always, go online to chcradio.com to sign up for our email updates. You can also share your thoughts and your comments about this program with us. Valerie, thank you again so much for taking the time to meet with us today and share your story.
Thank you.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.